This time on the Plutopia podcast, our guests are the Talking Heads. No, not those talented musicians, our homegrown Talking Heads, John Dubkowski, Scoop Sweeney, and Wendy Grossman. We do a deep dive into TSA shakedowns, billionaires and their playthings, air conditioning, ICE abductions, LA, Juneteenth, hometowns and highways, regime change, MAGA mischief, abortion, right to die laws, cannibalism and food safety, spicy cuisine, and Joe Rogan.
Hello, everybody. Here we are again, the Plutopia News Network podcast. I'm John Lebkoski. That's hard to pronounce, isn't it? Lebkoski? People like to call me Lebowski. People call me Jeff Lebowski sometimes, and I really try to live up to that. Anyway, I'm John Lebkoski, and my partner over there in Bastrop County is Scoop Sweeney. We're both in Texas. And our co-host, Wendy Grossman, is in London. Or is that where you are right now?
No, I'm in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania.
Oh, well, so she is normally in London, but right now she is in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania.
So did you have trouble with our entrance to the country? I mean, you came in from a foreign land. Did they shake you down? And
No, I have global entry. They waved me through.
Uh-huh.
You know, I mean, I actually do have some friends who at least know people who've been turned back at the border. And at least one of my friends turned down a rather lucrative paying gig that was going to happen in the States because he just didn't want to take the risk. But, you know, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people are crossing the border every day and not being stopped. So but you know, the stories that people see in, you know, overseas where, you know, you have tourists being stopped and detained and so on, it scares people. And so I'm not at all surprised to read that, you know, tourism is down and it could be actually quite expensive for the US.
Yeah, tourism is suffering, and even things like Airbnb and VRBO, rental properties that people will use for their vacations, they're suffering because people just don't know if they'll be able to get into the country.
Well, it's a real problem for conferences also, because if you put your conference in the United States, there's a bunch of people who aren't going to come here, you know, either because they're worried about being arrested or because they're worried about, they just don't like what's happening in the States and they don't want to support it. And if you put it outside the U.S., a bunch of graduate students and other researchers inside the States are afraid to leave because they're afraid they might not get back in. So, you know, we are going to have to do what I thought was inevitably going to happen, which is that we have to get really good at hybrid conferences.
You know, it's kind of interesting. I felt that some people who are actually citizens but are on some list somewhere would have trouble getting into the U.S. I actually would have thought, if you had asked me before you came back, if I thought you would get in, I said, no, they're going to stop you and they're going to say, you have something to do with that Plutopia News Network podcast, don't you?
We may be exaggerating our importance in the world.
Yeah, but I don't think people are really having trouble getting back into the U.S.
But people are nervous about it. And that's actually, you know, quite a deterrent effect.
Yeah, what you said about global conferences, we have had to do this starting back in COVID, and we just kept with it because it seems it's a lot easier than having to track someone down across the country when you could just have them connect in. And we've had some really great international conversations, including you, of course.
Oh yeah, I was not going to be a regular on Plutopia if I had to spend my life in Austin, Texas. Not that I have anything against Austin, you understand, but it is very hot there and I don't really like air conditioning.
It's very hot. And this house I'm in, it's very cold.
See, this is it. It's 68 degrees in the room I'm in at the moment. It's 85 outside. I would like the temperature inside to be closer to the temperature outside so that I could acclimate a bit, you know.
There's significant debate about that within our house here. We actually have two air conditioners too. We have one for upstairs and one for downstairs, but they don't work together very well.
Yeah, we have the same setup here. I have one on the side of the studio, which I have to turn off when we're doing anything because it gets rather loud. The other side is the master bedroom, which stays nice and crispy, clean, and cool.
So you're basically boasting about how much energy you use?
Absolutely. We love energy. I've got a lot of energy stocks. I've got to keep pumped up.
This is actually an issue with me because if it was me, I would never set the thermostat below 75.
Yeah,
And I
me
might
too.
even have it on 78,
Which is
but
why,
I
as
have
you can
others
see,
in
I
the
am wearing a
house.
giant warm shirt because I'm actually cold.
No thermostat in the room?
The thermostat is in the hallway outside, and I think it would as much as my life is worth to touch it.
Ah, so we were going to talk about, I
Billionaires.
guess, current events. Yeah, billionaires, starting with billionaires for sure. I may even know a billionaire or two, but they never seem like billionaires to me.
I just read a story that Alexander Pavlov, I think that's his, Durov, the guy who owns Telegram. He has six children by various women, and then he has another like 94 in 12 countries that have been conceived via his sperm donation.
Oh, great. Sound like a Musk wannabe.
Well, except that he wants to leave all his money to all his children. Like he want, you know, so if you're one of the 100, you get a share.
Well, I mean, if it's a billionaire, that's probably still a significant sum of money.
Well, yes, you know, and it may incur, you know, apparently he is considering donating more sperm and getting and wants more children, you know, and you know.
Well, the problem with talking about billionaires or thinking about billionaires for me is that I don't understand their perspective at all. I mean, I don't understand. I could imagine what my perspective would be if I was a billionaire, but I would probably imagine wrong. I would probably see the world a lot differently than I can ever hope to realize. If I actually was a billionaire.
Was it Abigail Disney or was it the Walmart heiress who said that if she couldn't understand why a billionaire couldn't live just as well on 999,999,999?
Well, one of the Walmart heiresses took out a big full-page ad in a lot of newspapers just recently. Basically criticizing the tariffs and the way Trump was handling the economy. And I thought that was interesting. I've always wondered why these people don't come out and say, you know, how much is enough money? They never seem to really say, well, I've got enough, but they always seem to be wanting to get just a little bit more.
I
Yeah,
have
you
this.
know, I tell people I have something no billionaire could ever have.
What's
It
that?
Enough.
Yeah. Well, it does. They're different types of billionaires. I mean, that's the thing is when we talk about billionaires, what we really mean are these very dysfunctional tech guys who have, you know, started out reasonably well off and started out some at least somewhat wealthy and then made themselves into these enormous billionaires, but there's lots of other kinds of billionaires, people who inherit, people who you know, well, as I say, inherit, you know, there's whole offices that are run for these families now. I actually read a book on family offices, and they do things like they leave assets, you know, they skip a generation so they don't have to pay more in inheritance tax, and they do all this sort of planning. And you know, that came up in the Theranos fraud because, you know, people were, I think it was one of the DeVos family, wasn't it, who had put in, I don't know, $100 million or something, and the person managing the fund seemed to have paid absolutely no attention to doing any sort of due diligence on Theranos and its products. And it was sort of like, well, but you know, if it's pocket change, why would you bother? You know, I mean, Rupert Murdoch lost $150 million on Theranos, and it sounds like a lot of money until you think of it in terms of his net worth, and it's a tiny percentage.
I don't know for sure, but I think that Mackenzie Scott is somewhat scrupulous about
Yes.
screening the people who want money from her and making sure that
Yeah,
they're going to
I
make
get the
good use of
sense
the
sometimes she's
funds.
trying to undo some of Bezos's harm.
Well, our favorite local billionaire, Elon, what's his name, is not having a good month or actually year. He blew up another rocket and a rather extreme explosion. It was just a test. And when you can't even test your product, you have a product problem. And it blew up the entire launch platform and all the surroundings there. It was an enormous fireball. And what's terrible is he now owns the city that
Yes.
is around Starbase. Now it's now Starbase, Texas, and he has managed to drive out many of the local residents and buy out the rest. So it's pretty much a company town now, which is reminiscent of the old
Yeah.
oligarchs and billionaires who used to
Is he
have
going to pay
company
them in,
towns.
is he going to pay people in cryptocurrency scrip?
No, he's going to give them all a free ticket to Mars.
But you know, all he has to do actually to turn himself into a massive success is to change his mission statement. Instead of his mission statement being to get to Mars, it's to blow things up.
He blowed up real good.
Well, I mean, this is not meant to be too much in his defense. And I'm not sure that the fact that the rocket blew up had anything to do with anything he did. But rockets that are being tested actually do often blow up. And the question regarding whether it was a successful test or not is whether they learn something from that test and
Right.
whether they understand why the thing blew up.
Right. I don't know if you've seen it, but Netflix has out a new documentary on the Titan submersible.
I'm aware of it. I haven't seen it.
Yeah, I saw that, and it's pretty amazing and really
Yeah.
horrifying at the lack of due diligence done in that product, that project.
It's astonishing. I mean, there are all these engineers sort of basically telling the guy, what was it, Gavin Rush? Was that his name?
I'm
That's
not
going to be
sure. I
my
don't
name today.
remember.
But you know, they're telling the guy who's running the project, you know, carbon fiber is not strong enough for this. You cannot do this. And you know, there are all these, they show, you know, sort of the thing being submersed, and you hear all these popping sounds. And they're trying to say it's being seasoned when actually what's happening is that fibers are breaking.
Yeah.
It was Stockton Rush. Yeah.
Stockton Rush, that's his name.
Yeah,
Yeah.
a really telling part of that was the woman who walked away just before the final dive of that ill-fated
Yeah.
submarine, and her she back she confronted him saying, this is not safe. It is not going to. I can't do it. And she walked away, and the very next dive was when they blew up.
Was that the woman who stayed as long as she did because she would have had to leave during COVID and all her friends were losing their jobs?
I think that was the one
Yeah.
of the
Because
reasons.
there were two women. The other one was an accountant, I think. And
Yeah.
they were going to put her in charge. They were going to make her a pilot or something of this submersible. And she's sort of, are you crazy?
Yeah, she was, seemed to be the one that had the most common sense and the most technical knowledge of what was going on, and no one was listening.
Well, also there was that lovely Scottish engineer who, you know, actually tried to blow the whistle. And this was one of the sort of appalling things, was that this guy tried to blow the whistle on this thing, and it ended up being, you know, really expensive. And eventually, I think the government agency that he was dealing with said, "Okay, we have your information. There are 11 cases older than yours ahead of you."
Well, that was David Lockridge,
That
right?
was David Lockridge, and
Talking to the American Bureau of Shipping.
Right. And at that point he had to give up because they just couldn't afford the time and the money to pursue it. And that's a regulatory failure. You know,
I
it
don't understand myself how anybody could get inside of that thing. I mean, I have a very profound case of claustrophobia, and I
Yeah.
wouldn't have lasted a minute inside of that vessel. I would have been clawing the walls.
People, I think the idea that they were, you know, that they were going to do something miraculous, you know, they were going to do something that hadn't been done. And I mean, it's this, you know, if you think about the old days, I mean, the old days, you know, the era in which a lot of the great exploration of the world was done. I mean, it would be that same type of personality, wouldn't it? That you know, would get on a boat with Magellan or
Yeah, I mean,
a boat
somebody who's
with
crazy,
Columbus.
basically.
Somebody who's a bit crazy and is a risk taker and is but is fascinated by the opportunity to explore the unknown.
Yeah, it's a case of testosterone overload, really, because I've seen that happen so much with people I know or people I've encountered, of just that I'm a manly man, I can't show any fear, and I'll just do it. And a lot of them ended up doing it and dying, and
You can do that. You can do that and prepare. You know, I mean, that's what it's the appalling thing is. Stockton Rush seems to have begun to believe his own, you know, sort of press. You know, he there's a quote. There's a bit of a clip of him saying, you know, I'm not going to die. No one is going to die in this thing. You know, and he was sort of saying, look, they've been saying I'm crazy for 8 years, but you know, this is. I am absolutely certain that I'm right. And I mean, I think Christopher Columbus probably did a lot more testing of his boat than that.
Well, I mean, it's the human problem of hubris.
Yeah.
And we see a lot of it in our politics right now. We have people making political decisions that are almost certainly going to cause disasters of various kinds. And they feel or seem to feel that what they're doing is going to be entirely successful for the good of all. It's just crazy.
Or that's the line they're selling about it.
Yeah, I was really lucky that I had a college professor at the University of North Texas back in the late 60s that taught the class how to say it's time to leave, or how to stop talking a few sentences earlier than you did. Just re reminding people they need to really, use the brain as well as the mouth when you're, doing business or whatever, when you're doing a life. And that was probably the most helpful class that I had in all of my college days, was getting someone to talk with a sense of realism about how to survive in the world. You didn't get a lot of that from a lot of the courses. I took a lot of business courses, so business was all, you're going to be big, you're going to be wonderful, you're going to get rich. No, it doesn't work that way usually.
I'm ready to get rich. I'm working on my first million.
By a lot of people's standards in this world, you are rich.
Actually, I'm quite aware of that. I have a very comfortable life, and it disturbs me to see how much difficulty some people are having to endure and how much of that difficulty is being caused by it. Assholes, basically, who appear to have no empathy or no care for other people. And the worst of that right now is we have basically thugs in masks with nothing to identify them, yet they're supposedly law enforcement. Now, when did we ever have that? When did we ever have law enforcement that weren't required to identify themselves? And in fact, these guys are able to hide behind a mask. They're wearing regular street clothes. They're in cars that have no identification, and they're grabbing people off the street. I mean, if somebody grabs me off the street and they're, dressed that way and in that kind of car, am I supposed to assume that they're law enforcement and that they have some right to arrest me?
Yeah, the laws in most states have always, as I understood it, required law enforcement to identify themselves as law enforcement. You had to say, I'm a cop, I'm police, you know, I'm state trooper, whatever. And they have to have identification, you know, a badge and a peace officer's license that they're required to. I don't know if all these people actually have any of those, because there's no way to identify them. If you're wearing,
well,
it could be the gardener from down the street who decided to be a cop.
They are required to identify themselves, but requirements don't mean very much right now. Laws don't mean very much right now. We have an executive administration that has decided it'll just do whatever the hell it wants to do, regardless of whether it's legal or not.
Have you actually in person seen any of these abductions?
I have only seen them on video, and I've heard them described. And I can't say whether they didn't. They might have used their words to say, we are ICE agents and we are here to arrest you. But I have heard that they don't.
I've heard that they don't. I ask merely out of curiosity, because it's very hard to get a sense of how frequent it really is and how many people are being picked up that way. And the thing that I've seen recently, I was talking to a friend of mine who reads, you know, he reads the Murdoch press. And I said to him, you do know that in Los Angeles, these protests and stuff that they keep talking about, that it's just a few streets. It's like the whole city is not in flames. And he was surprised. But everything I read on, you know, all the friends I have in Los Angeles, the people I read on social media who are there, they all say the same thing, which is that, you know, the protests occupy a small area around the federal building and a couple of other places. And then the rest of the city is, you know, enormous. And there's nothing happening there.
Yeah, well, our vice president, Juvenile Delinquent Vance, was in Los Angeles this week and going on about how Trump had saved the city because it was going to be inflamed and burned to the ground. And it's like, come on, I've been to L.A. I did business in L.A. And that area that was having troubles is a very tiny part of a very large city.
Well, one of the funny things that I read about that was somebody saying that the Northeastern media have never understood L.A. And they had this quote from The New York Times that was talking about something in Santa Monica and said it was close to downtown L.A. And it's actually further from downtown L.A. than the entire length of Manhattan.
Yeah, the metropolitan area there is huge. And
it's
just
enormous.
Because you're part of that area doesn't mean you're near downtown.
Because it was all villages, and then the car came and tied them all together, mm-hmm. You know, basically.
No, I was just going to say, I think that I would just avoid going to any Home Depot.
Well, but the other thing about it is, you know, even those huge fires a few months ago in LA, I mean, I have a niece that lived close to where one of the fires was, and she could see it sort of coming close, and then it veered off and went somewhere else or got contained or something. And even that was a small, relatively small percentage of LA, devastating as it was.
Yeah, these things are always smaller than they're made out to be. I mean, the media blows everything up, right? They're just inherently going to do that.
The reason it got so much attention is these weren't ghetto neighborhoods mostly. They were some very upscale, you know, Pacific Palisades was where a lot of multi-zillionaires had their big homes. And when those folks are impacted, then it gets big media coverage. If you burn the ghetto, it's just like, well, they probably did it themselves.
You know, the sitcom producer, Chuck Lorre, you know, he does these vanity cards at the end of every episode that he does. And I think it was a couple of weeks later, I forget which show it was, but at the end he had this card about thanking the fire service that had managed to save his house. His neighbor's house burned down and they saved his house. and offering to take them to dinner. And it was just the nicest thank you, you know, sort of. You could feel the gratitude in every word.
Yeah, and you can't help but feel sorry for even the big stars who lost their homes, because you think about, you have all your most treasured possessions from your career, and they're all gone. That would be bad. I would have trouble with that.
Oh yeah, I mean, you know, and I think the things that I saw from some of the famous names at the time said, you know, we recognize that we have another house, and but it was still a loss of personal stuff and memories, and even some of the houses that were saved were uninhabitable afterwards.
Yeah.
So what do you think about, Juneteenth was a couple of days ago, and one noticeable thing on Juneteenth was that Donald Trump avoided mentioning it. I mean, it's a federal holiday, but he
Oh,
didn't say a
he
word about
sort of mentioned it when he said there were too many holidays.
Yeah, that's one he was thinking.
it. Well, I mean, and his point there is that it shouldn't be a holiday. And it's part of their fairly broad effort to do away with any acknowledgement that there are any races other than the white race, I guess.
Yeah, they've been scrubbing the museums and libraries and anything that has any kind of federal funding, trying to clean them up and getting rid of any DEI stuff.
Well, my feeling is that Juneteenth is here to stay, and that if it's not an official holiday, it will remain a cultural holiday, and that nothing's going to change that.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of
Unless you
interesting. It
decide to
start.
arrest everybody who participates in it. Like, which country is it that's made pride illegal?
Well, they're trying here.
No, there
Yeah.
is actually a country. I think it might be,
I mean, they're
is it
suppressing it
Hungary?
here.
Or Pol I think it might be Hungary.
I will check my Junior Woodchuck's guidebook in Hungary. Yes. Okay. The Junior Woodchuck's guidebook says that it's Hungary.
Okay.
Well, so when I was a kid, Juneteenth was something that was celebrated in Texas. It was considered a Texas thing. And I
I
was
never
actually kind
heard
of
of it.
surprised that it became a national holiday. Well, I mean,
I never heard of it until a few years ago.
it's about something that happened in Texas, and the Juneteenth was celebrated by blacks when I was a kid, and people were all kind of aware of it. Whites didn't really celebrate it. It was a black celebration. So it's evolved over time. And, we've made all of this progress in the acknowledgement of the fact that people who are not white are also human beings, and that they're just as smart as anybody else, and they're just as capable as anybody else, and they're not genetically inferior or whatever the hell the arguments are. This is like 50 years of progress in building that acknowledgement. And the same thing with LGBTQ and pride. And it's all being hammered down. Like, I mean, it's so destructive. It's such a terrible thing.
Yeah, they're attacking a lot of things that have been done to undo the influence of the people that promoted all the Confederate monuments and Confederate holidays, because that was brought about mainly in the early 20th century, when they had a resurgence of the Ku Klux Klan and a lot of anti-black legislation that was common in the Deep South, and even in other states, outside of the Deep South, had some pretty astounding laws. Things like the poll tax, where you had to pay to cast your vote, and it took a long time to get rid of a lot of these things. And Trump wants to bring them all back.
I've been reading a book by Deborah Archer called Dividing Lines about racism and highways. And one of the points she makes is that once we had these laws, you know, sort of establishing civil rights and banning segregation and things like that, as a sort of as a bypass, there's a nice pun. Some of these highways were deliberately built to, you know, keep black people from going to the right to the wrong part of town, and deliberately somehow the place you put your highway was always running through a black community that, you know, was maybe a bit shabby, and you didn't want you wanted to, you know, you wanted to clear up.
Yeah, the interstate highways. Our hometown, that where John and I grew up, it was bypassed by Interstate 20, which used to go through the downtown area, and they routed it north of town and completely avoided any of the central business district, which immediately just died. And that's happened in a lot of small rural communities where the big highway suddenly goes elsewhere, and so does their business.
Well, apparently, quite often the places that they went elsewhere to that got shafted that way were black communities and black businesses.
I'm trying to remember what the thing was with. The town we're from is Big Spring, Texas. And originally it was on some trail. And it became a populated area because of, well, there was a spring there.
Well, that's
So
why it was a
obviously there was a
trail.
reason to stop for the spring. And then they discovered oil there, and that sort of
Oh,
ramped it up a
so
bit.
basically you're the Beverly Hillbillies.
It's made some Beverly Hillbillies type families. But it was originally on a Comanche war trail.
Yeah, that was it.
That went through the area because of the springs. It was a source of water, and it
And
was.
before that, it was an animal trail. I mean, living things all need the same things.
And I guess, was it Highway 87 that they,
Yeah, well, that was the North-South Highway. Still going
yeah.
down.
What was the east-west?
East-West was Highway 80. And then
Highway 80, okay.
came Interstate 20.
I
And
mean, we're really famous for the fact that they filmed the movie Hangar 18 in Big Spring.
the beginning of Midnight Cowboy, that's where.
Yeah, I was going to mention that too, but Hangar 18 kind of makes me laugh.
Yeah.
If you've ever seen that movie, yeah,
No, I haven't, but I've seen Midnight Cowboy. I'll have to go back and look.
Yeah, if you're watching, when you watch Midnight Cowboy, when it opens, there's this whole part of it that takes place in Texas when Joe Buck is a young guy. Yeah, and then he leaves his little town in Texas. He gets on a bus that sometimes goes east and sometimes goes west. I mean, if you know the terrain there, you understand that they shot the bus going in opposite directions, even though you wouldn't know that otherwise. And the rest of the film takes place in New York, but there was that rape scene where he sort of was present when a young girl was being raped, and that was shot in Stanton, Texas, which is about what, 20 miles scoop from Big Spring.
Yeah, it's about 20 miles west.
So they shot an appreciable amount of footage there, and it was kind of a big deal at the time it happened. I think a lot of the residents of Big Spring have probably forgotten now that it ever occurred.
I had put up a suggestion for something we should talk about that's very current, and that's of course what's going on between Israel and Iran, and President what's his name's attempts to not be involved but somehow always getting involved with what's going on. So regime change is a big deal now in the news, and that's this country has a really bad history of its use of regime change. The Republic of Texas was a victim of that. That used to be an independent republic, and all of a sudden the United States annexed it, same way it did a lot of other areas, such as California.
And eventually Canada and Greenland?
That's a work in progress, apparently.
Yeah.
But, you know, they've, you know, tried all sorts of regime change. You know, the Bay of Pigs was a rather notorious failed one. Most of them seemed to fail. You know, they had a few successes in the area of regime change, but they, you know, when it comes to Iran, they, you know, had a really bad one because they overthrew several leaders. You know, this Shah of Iran was installed, and he was kicked out by the current government.
The current regime, yeah.
But before Shah of Iran came around, they had a democratically elected minister, Mohammed, I can't even pronounce his name anyway. But yeah, that was a CIA coup back in 1953. So they've had their hands into a lot of really bad ideas for regime change.
Well, the thing that I noticed here is that Donald Trump, who was opposed to any kind of intervention in Iran, suddenly started to favor it when Israel attacked Iran, and it appeared to be working. It appeared to be successful. They appeared to be winning. And then Trump started talking about it as though he had been behind it all along and was involved, you know, was what he started using the word "we" quite a bit in describing the things that were being done there. And I think it was just kind of like the typical thing with him, is he sees something that's a show of strength and where there appears to be a win, and he adopts it, you know, as his own thing.
Have you not worked out, John, that it's actually un-American to have a good memory?
It can get you in trouble in some areas.
Well, I'm a good American then, because my memory's going fast.
Yeah, well, my memory lasted enough to where I remember some of our other failures. Yeah, Vietnam was one misadventure. We should have known better, because the French gave up on it and said, you take it. You know, it's like a football game. You know, and it was, you know, the U.S., you know, turned to screw things up, and it didn't end well. And it was all basically because Standard Oil of New Jersey decided that there was some great money to be made by the oil reserves that were just offshore of Vietnam. So that spiraled out of control, and we ended up losing a lot of lives and a lot of money, and losing the war as well.
I mean, I guess. I mean, whoever wins a war.
Well, I see this pictures, you know, of the destruction that's going on in Gaza and in Ukraine and all these other places, and it just seems so incredibly wasteful to me.
That is terrible. It's terrible. There's no excuse for war, except there's plenty of excuses offered.
Well, when I was in school, we were told that when a colony of any particular animal gets too numerous and starts to outrun its resources, either they have diseases that kill off some of them, or they have war, or they fight amongst themselves. We seem to be doing both of those things.
Actually, one of my crazy theories has been that the kind of stuff that we see happening now is really about population control, even if we don't quite realize that's what we're doing. And, you know, I've been thinking a lot about how the people who are in power in the United States right now really seem to have no concern about whether people are going to die or not. We have this tradition in the US of standing up for human life and trying to, help everybody survive and trying to ensure that anyone who has a potentially fatal problem that they get that it gets addressed as well as we possibly can. And that's just kind of gone. That's out the window. And the only lives that seem to matter to the MAGA folks are the lives of unborn children, though they don't care so much about those lives once those children are born.
Well, George Carlin had a line about that.
What did he say?
I think it had swear words in
Well, we do swear words.
know, but I can't remember exactly.
Oh, okay. But yes, George Carlin knew, I think he was a good futurist. He was kind of seeing where this is all heading, and he wasn't far off. I've listened to recently, actually, to some of his old routines, and they were very nostalgic for, at the time he was doing it, it was, the 70s and 80s. And we thought that things were bad then. I mean, those were the good old days.
I've got the quote actually. It says, "Boy, these conservatives are really something, aren't they? They're all in favor of the unborn. They'll do anything for the unborn. But once you're born, you're on your own. Pro-life conservatives are obsessed with the fetus from conception to 9 months. After that, they don't want to know about you. They don't want to hear from you. No nothing, no neonatal care, no daycare, no head start, no school lunch, no food stamps, no welfare, no nothing. If you're preborn, you're fine. If you're preschool, you're fucked."
And all of that is coming true as we speak. They're cutting the SNAP benefits, where you could feed kids. I mean, that there's nothing wrong about that program other than the fact that somebody thinks it's money that should be spent on something other than kids.
Well, this week in Britain, abortion has been legal in Britain since 1967. That's how most people see it. It's not quite true. Abortion is legal only under certain circumstances, and under all other circumstances, it's a criminal offense. So the circumstances under which it's legal are that it's gestation to 24 weeks, and two doctors have to sign off. And in practice, that has been, I think it's probably, I think it's fair to say it's been uneven. There are definitely places in the UK where it's been difficult. And in Northern Ireland, the Abortion Act was never extended to Northern Ireland until just a few years ago. But in recent years, prosecutions under the criminal part, under the non-exception, have been rising. And COVID had something to do with this because people were receiving pills through the mail, and there's no way to check that maybe they were only supposed to take the pills up to about 10 weeks, and maybe there were a couple of cases where they were taken later, and in cases of stillbirth, sometimes women were being investigated. So this week, Parliament voted to remove women from the criminal statute. Now, that statute dates back to 1861, so you might say it was a long past time, but it happened. It's not what some of the more progressives wanted. What they really wanted was for the criminal statute to be repealed. But we got this far. So there will be fewer prosecutions of women who are in pain because they lost a child.
In the US, though, they're prosecuting women who have miscarriages.
Yeah, that was the sort of thing that was happening, was the police were beginning to investigate. That's what they did. That's why they voted the way they did, was to stop that.
You find cities here in Texas that have laws against traveling through their area
Oh, I saw that.
To get an abortion. You know, Lubbock and Amarillo, I think, were some of the cities or the counties that were actively trying to, you know, do that. I think they finally got some injunctions against them and made them knock it off. But
so were they stopping it? Was there ever a roadblock or anything where they stopped every woman of childbearing age to ask her where she was going?
Yeah, I'm not sure they've had any enforcement yet. It was basically more, you know, grandstanding. You know, see how reactionary we are. We passed this law. They're probably afraid to do it because it cost them a fortune to, you know, in appeal money to make it work.
The other astonishing thing that happened in Britain this week, also in Parliament, was they voted to legalize assisted dying. And those came after months of debate, and it came about like the original Abortion Act came about because one of the MPs won the lottery to bring in a private member's bill, and this was the issue she chose.
So they're basically trying to do a right to die.
And it still has to go to the House of Lords, and there will be amendments. I would think there will be amendments, and there has to be royal assent, but. Everybody seems to think it will now go through.
Well, it, you know, has been attempted, you know, in North America, and just, you know, was way too early, I guess, because, Kevorkian, you know, he paid the price for, you know, his attempts at assisted suicide. And
it's legal in California, though. And I think the California law is part of the model they used for the British law. I think you have to have a medical condition that is expected to kill you within 6 months. In California, the rule is that you have to be able to do it yourself.
There are people who supposedly are on the dark web marketing DIY suicide kits, and a few of them, I think, were shut down, but that's the kind of thing that crops up on the dark web, especially just anything that's really outrageous, as far as local morals are concerned, you'll find it there. And I'd seen one listing for it, but it went away quickly.
Do you remember like what's sort of astonishing is like these things are happening now and they're real, but when the internet was young, you know, I remember there was a site that scandalized all sorts of gullible newspapers, you know, that purported to sell man beef, and you could buy basically human flesh for consumption.
Oh, Lord.
And it was, you know, it was a pure joke, you know, but several newspapers got taken in by it and wrote these scandalized pieces about how shocking it was that this was out there. It was, you know, it was kind of nice when a lot of this stuff was just nonsense.
Yeah, it sounds like an episode from that TV series Bones, where they had a evil guy who was getting all of his acolytes to go out and murder people and bring him his meal. It's like, oh, God, thanks.
I saw that, and I thought that was Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Well, they probably did it first. You know, Bones came along, you know, well after that. But
because David Boreanaz was a fledgling when he did Buffy.
Yeah. No cannibalism here. I'm on a diet.
Well, it's low fat and it's gluten free.
Actually, I'm developing a fear of food because I no longer believe that food safety is much of a priority for government.
That's a real sticking point in the trade agreement that is supposed to be going on between the U.S. and the EU, the U.K. No one in Europe really wants American food standards imported. I mean, even before the Trump administration, the thing that everybody writes about in the UK is chlorinated chicken.
Chlorinated chicken?
Yeah, it's in the States. You know, if you soak chicken in chlorinated water in order to make sure that it's not carrying salmonella.
Well, they also shoot them full of antibiotics, which is really bad because the people are getting, so many antibiotics in their food and elsewhere that they're becoming resistant, and they're all the resistant, diseases that have cropped up that aren't necessarily curable by normal antibiotics.
And then there's also all the stuff about genetically modified organisms, Frankenfoods,
Yeah.
Edwards used to call them.
And ultra processed
And
foods.
there's a whole general thing about processed foods, yes, because large parts of Europe still are very proud of their local cheeses and local meats and local, recipes and so forth. And it used to be you would come to the States and you would get huge portions of really interesting, you could, there's still a lot of interesting cooking in the States, really. But I noticed that my friends in the States worry much more about food safety than I do. And some of that is because I'm generally not a worrier, but some about that kind of thing. But some of it is I think because they feel that they really do have some reason to believe that they have to.
Yeah, there's a big fear of romaine these days.
Oh yeah, it's supposed to be good
Romaine,
for you.
yeah, well, except for the Listeria.
We used to eat out a lot, say in the 80s and 90s, and it got to the point where, my wife and I decided that we were getting sick from food that we'd had at supposedly good restaurants. And realize that the standards for safety and healthy preparation of food had kind of fallen on bad times because I know that a number of people that I've grown up with have stopped going out to eat because they don't trust what's in the food, and
Really?
I go out and buy, nice, clean, food and cook it myself because, I've just got tired of having bowel disorders and I didn't have any until I was eating out at some of these supposedly great restaurants.
I do most of my own cooking just because it's easier and cheaper, and I like my own cooking. And also, I do have allergies, and so I don't have to wonder what's in the food, as you say. But the thing I notice is, like, if I go to any of the major cities, you get really very good food there in restaurants and stuff. That's as you would expect. But if you're out in the sort of middle of the country, there seems to be a lot of sort of mid-range chains. And they all taste the same to me. And I'm not sure why.
The discipline thing is gentrifying the ethnic foods. I've gone to some Mexican restaurants over the years that don't taste like Mexican food. It's been whitened up, and that's just I get angry when I encounter that. I've actually gone to the cook and said, "What is wrong with you?" Well, people complain it was too spicy. It's Mexican food.
Well, but I lived in Mexico for a summer, and Mexican food isn't always spicy. It's really more the stuff on the side that's spicy, and the family that I lived with anyway was quite happy to, sort of each one had a different spice tolerance for spice, and they were able to, that seemed sensible. But I will tell you, right after the Computers Freedom and Privacy Conference in 1998, when it was in Austin, Texas, three of us went out for dinner somewhere. I can't remember if it was Tex-Mex, it probably was. But one of our number, who happened to work for the NSA, called over, he was looking at the menu and he said, "I feel in the mood for something really spicy."
I remember that guy.
Yeah. And so, the waiter comes over and he says, Is this really spicy?" He said, "Well, would you like a sample of the sauce to taste?" And he said, "Oh yeah, that would be great." So the waiter brings him a little bowl of sauce and he tastes it. "Oh yeah, that's really spicy. I'll have that." So the food comes and he takes a bite and he turns bright purple. Sweat starts pouring down his face. And he calls the waiter and says, "Ha! And the waiter said, "Oh, it gets a lot spicier when you cook it."
Yeah.
Oh, that's
like,
great.
Oh, my God.
They left out some key information there. Yeah, I had that situation happen in a Thai restaurant in the Bay Area. One of my favorite Thai places that I would go and have, you know, Panang curry. And I brought along a musician friend of mine who had just had his hair permed up. That was the day of hair bands. And we had Panang curry. And all of a sudden I looked over and the whole left side of his hair had gone flat, and the guy looked like he was having a stroke. He was turning red. It's like, he goes, "You said it was spicy." I said, "Well, it's Thai spicy."
I knew there was a reason I don't eat Thai food.
Oh, it's good for you.
No,
you know, Austin is definitely a spicy food town now. Pretty much everywhere you go, they make things spicy.
This is why I guess I can't visit Austin.
Well, sure you can.
Well, starve.
There's places you can go where food is bland.
Thank you. I am of Swiss descent. Well, Swiss and Romanian descent. And I have never had much tolerance for spicy food, unfortunately.
But I went through a whole period when I avoided spicy foods, and part of that time it actually disagreed with me. And I recall being with some of my friends in the Bay Area. They actually had they'd formed a kind of group called the Hatch Working Group, where they had originally met at the Hatch Chili Festival, and realized their common love of really hot, spicy foods. And we all went to a barbecue joint, and they were all insisting on the spiciest of spicy barbecue sauce. And I ordered the mild sauce with mine. And the guy who had taken my order when the order was ready came out and said, Here's yours with the mild sauce."
He was trying to show that you weren't really a man.
It was terrible embarrassment. I never lived it down.
One of my neighbors in East Oakland, when I lived there, was owner of a really fine Jamaican barbecue place. And I'd never had Jamaican barbecue. And I went to her place, and they had signs there that said, "If you order the hot barbecue, be aware it is really hot. It's not like anything you ever had." And I tried it, and I almost met my maker on that. It was really hot. I thought I could tolerate it, so I had to dial it down to the medium sauce. But Jamaican, they use Scotch bonnet peppers, which are extremely hot.
We should do a whole episode on spice.
That works.
Yeah.
Maybe we should do a cooking episode with recipes.
I know. We haven't really had any cooks on. I wonder if we could find somebody who is really into cuisine to join us.
I know a lot of good eaters.
Actually, I should say to our followers who are listening to this, if you've tolerated us so far, feel free to make suggestions. There's a way to do that on our website. We're kind of open to anything. In fact, I was appreciating recently, I was kind of looking back and appreciating the diversity of guests that we've had. It makes it kind of hard to define who we are and what we're about, because we don't focus on any one particular thing, but it's all fun and interesting.
Interesting conversations with interesting people.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, and that in itself is a great thing to be, because there are too many, one-hit wonders around. You can listen to Joe Rogan if you want to. I mean, I don't want to, but he's pretty much a one-hit wonder.
I'm going to briefly defend Joe Rogan, actually. I haven't heard his podcast since he moved to Spotify, and I understand that he has veered off a lot more right-wing than he was. But before that, at the be very beginning of COVID, March 2020, he had on Michael Ostroff. God, I'm really bad with names today. He works at the SIDRAP, the place in Minnesota. It's a it's a medical outfit, and you know, this guy. The thing that's good about Rogan and the thing that's bad about Rogan is that he will talk to somebody for 3 hours. And so,
yeah,
you know, if you
who would listen though for 3 hours?
People who can't sleep.
Yeah.
No. Oh, there you go.
Yeah. And in order to pull that off, you really have to be someone already.
Right. But the point is that that you can get a lot out of somebody in 3 hours. And like his conversation with Joseph Lessig, Michael Osterholm, that's the name I'm trying to think of. His conversation with Lawrence Lessig or with Bernie Sanders or any one of a number of these people were really interesting. And I was the thing where I discovered him was I've always been interested in doping in sports. And he got a couple of important names in doping on sports. He had Victor Conti, who was the heart of the Balco scandal. And you know, you can learn a lot about something like that in 3 hours. And Michael Osterholm was no exception. He talked about COVID. And the first thing he said, when if you go back to March 12th, 2020, was, this is serious. It's airborne. You know, it's good. And so on. And so, you know, I took my cue from that. And it probably saved me, you know, making a couple of serious mistakes in terms of COVID. So, you know, whatever he is now, there was a time when his podcast was actually useful.
Well, the idea of a 3-hour interview strikes me more of an interrogation than an interview. It's like, okay, I'll confess anything. The Kennedy assassination, just let me go.
Well, I think that's where the sort of dumb guy persona he has is helpful, because he basically, he'll sit there and he'll say, you know, he'll ask anything. You know, if you start talking about something, he doesn't know what it is, he will ask.
I think he's a really good interviewer.
You know, and the other thing is there were a lot of comedians who have podcasts that I actually find interesting. Mark Maron has had one for 16 years. He's talked to a lot of very interesting people. It's
yeah, he's good. Now.
Mike Birbiglia has a podcast where he and another comedian will sit and try to work out jokes in real time. I find that really, you know, there's a, anyway.
I don't know how far right Rogan can be and still be living in Austin, you know.
Well,
Austin tends to pull people to the left.
I don't think he's consistently as right wing as people think.
I think he's pretty, at least that he tries to be objective, but his selection of guests maybe sometimes feels like it leans to the right.
Oh, I think it does. Yeah. And male.
Well, there are a lot of media people that have seemed to kind of start leaning to the right since Trump took over. And it's I'm not sure why, maybe just trying to cater to a different audience.
I think he was actually leaning more to the right during the Biden administration. Because from what I read, there have been some cracks in the right-wing support lately.
Yeah, indeed. We've actually reached the end of our hour. I'm thinking of more stuff to say. We could talk for 3 hours, I guess.
No, I don't want to commit crimes that I've already committed.
Yeah. I don't think I would let. Well, you know, the thing is that I do think people are going to drop. I'm sure he's got fans that will listen to every episode and all 3 hours of every episode, but I tend to think he has a lot of drops, like after the first hour, maybe even after the first half hour.
Well, but, you know, he interviews somebody like Elon Musk, which he's done, and Musk actually was sitting there smoking dope, I believe, on one of their podcasts. You know, and Musk has a very large fan base.
Yeah, we should try to get Musk.
Oh, please.
I'm going to call in sick on that one.
I think we all would.
There you go.
Just leave Musk to sit here and interview himself.
So, well, this has been kind of a fun discussion.
We'll have to do it again next time we have a blank spot in the agenda.
Right on. It's always good to take some time for ourselves, isn't it? Yeah. All right. Well, thanks, Wendy. Thanks, Scoop.
Thanks, everyone. See you later, Taylor.
Off we go. Bye-bye.
You can stay in touch with Plutopia at plutopia.io. On Facebook, look for at Plutopia News. On Twitter, it's at Plutopia. This is the Plutopia News Network, 20 minutes into the future.